the meeting of the Inner West Local Planning Panel. In doing so, as chair, I should acknowledge the Gadigal and Wangal people of the Eora Nation, on whose country we are meeting today, their elders past and present. Next item is declarations of interest, there being none. When we commence these meetings, it's usual for us panel members to introduce ourselves, and we will quickly do that. I'm David Lloyd. In addition to chairing this panel, I chair a number of other panels. I am a lawyer, I am a QC, I am a former judge of the Land and Environment Court, a former acting judge of the Supreme Court, and currently a professor of law at Western Sydney University. Ms. Morrell.
Thank you, Chair. Jan Morrell, I'm a town planner. I currently only serve on independent planning panels, both local and at state level. And prior to retirement, I was a commissioner with the Land and Environment Court for 14 years. Thank you. And no conflict.
Okay. Mr. Johnson?
Yes, hi. My name's David Johnson. I am an environmental scientist and have been an environmental consultant for most of my life. I've also just recently spent 6 years as a member of the Planning Assessment Commission, now the Independent Planning Commission. Prior to that, I was an acting commissioner in the Land and Environment Court. I serve on two other local planning panels, and I do not have any declarations of conflict or interest on the matters today. Thank you.
And Ms. Roach.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Kath Roach. I run a company called Sync Solutions, which works all across a lot of councils in New South Wales. I sit on panels, but no other local planning panels. I was the Intern Ombudsman at Sutherland Shire Council for 5 years, and I worked at Housing New South Wales as their Exec Director of Governance and Regulation for a few years. On this particular panel, I'm here as the community representative.
Thank you. Well, with that, we can move straight on to the agenda items, the various development applications which we have to consider. The first item on the list is the proposed residential flat development at 314 Liverpool Road, Ashfield. I have noticed that there is a number of speakers who wish to speak on that matter. And the first name I have is Margaret Latham. Is Margaret Latham available?
Yes, I'm with Anthony Spartaro, my neighbour. So I live at 7 Miller Avenue. Can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear.
Oh, good. You'd like me to start now?
Yes. I should remind you, as I remind everyone, that the protocol governing these meetings allows members of the public to address the panel for up to 3 minutes. So your 3 minutes starts now.
Okay, thank you. The first thing I would like to say is more of a comment or a request regarding the overshadowing of the solar panels at the back of our house. We are retired and have made a substantial financial investment by installing solar panels on our west-facing roof to ease our electric bill shock in the coming years. Solar panels in the Inner West Council area are an exempt development, so we didn't need council approval to install them. However, as we are in a conservation area, we had to follow council's best practice for the location of our solar panels. That is, that the visual impact from Miller Avenue had to be reduced, and we had to avoid attaching them to the terracotta tiles on the older part of the roof because those tiles are so fragile. So we placed them on the newer roof at the back of the house. In the proposal, only one shadow study was done for June the 21st, the shortest day of the year. It clearly shows that our panels will be in shadow from 3 p.m. When we were first notified about the development proposal, I phoned council to discuss the problem with them and was told that further shadow studies would be requested. We were disappointed recently when we were notified that there were no extra shadow studies. Because our house sits to the east of the proposed development and because of the irregular shape of the roof of the proposed building, we're concerned how much our solar will be impacted by the shadows. I do know that some councils request shadow studies for different times of the year. We think that we deserve to have as much information at hand as possible. We could be facing a huge financial loss. We just don't know. because we're not experts in these shadow studies, yes. Secondly, I'd like to make a point about traffic and the entrance exit to the proposed development. I'm really shocked that the RMS has approved the entrance exit to the site, and I hope that members of the panel have been able to visit the site. The entrance is on Norton Street at a very dangerous bend and directly opposite the entrance to Carlisle Street. There are crash barriers on this corner and a mirror for vehicles exiting from Carlisle Street. These measures demonstrate how dangerous this corner is. The traffic on Norton Street can be heavy at times, particularly as a lot of drivers seem to use it as a thoroughfare from Liverpool Road to Milton Street. Cars and trucks pick up speed as they leave the Ashfield Mall area and often take that corner much too fast. So it's a very dangerous place to have an entrance exit to a development. My third point is that the proposed development does not fit in with our beautiful conservation area in terms of colour, materials or scale, as it should. The Queen Anne-style houses in the street still mostly display the original red brick walls, roofs and decorative timber work using... Is that my time?
You can go. Okay.
Yes.
You may finish.
Okay, thank you. Using traditional colours. The stark white, grey and rust colour scheme of the proposal is not at all sympathetic to the heritage colour schemes. And the rendered painted walls and the aluminium vertical shades also are in total contrast to the materials used in the conservation area. The modernistic block-like shapes of the proposed buildings and their bulk and scale will visually overpower and ruin the Miller Avenue conservation area. The proposed design is more in harmony with the commercial building at 320 Liverpool Road in terms of colour, materials, bulk and scale. We owners love the street that we live in. We have to strictly comply with council's development controls regarding renovations, additions, alterations of fences, etc. We're happy with that, but it seems unfair that a development of such contrast can be placed next to our properties and spoil our heritage significance. Thank you. That's all I have to say.
Thank you for that.
Thank you.
Thank you. The next speaker I have on my list is Antonio Spataro.
It's actually, can you hear me, by the way?
Yes, loud and clear.
Antonino, by the way. Anyway, can I start speaking now?
Yes, your 3 minutes starts now.
Okay. Well, I bring to the panel some proposed development issues. The first one is the retaining wall at the boundary at the back of our property and the proposed development. Our garage is about 1 metre from the retaining wall, and this can be seen in our submission photo. We're objecting because the retaining wall should be maintained and not damaged or altered in its present state, etc., during the process of building, such as digging up near it or heavy machinery going near it as well, and also to see it afterwards as well. We also object to the proposed plants planted near or next to the retaining wall due, once again, to the retaining wall being damaged. In my research, I found on the proposed plant called the one they want to put next to the fence, called the Manchurian pear tree, it will damage the retaining wall. As it is known, the Manchurian pear tree has roots that are considered invasive, and these roots should not be placed near the or go near the houses or other foundations or structures like the retaining wall. They've said also that they break through cracks of the concrete, and they should be planted their widths length away from the structure. So, and these plants are said to grow 10 feet to 30 feet in width. So they should be, if it's a 10 feet width, they should be put 10 feet away from any structure. And also they say that they also have safety problems, that have weak branches and that can easily break and, you know, maybe fall on your head or something like that. Anyway, there we also, us and the neighbours, we have to clean up the debris of these plants. And the council report didn't give mention to this, by the way. The second thing we want to point out is the heritage issue. Now, I love living in this street. I'm in Mellor Avenue, by the way, and it is a heritage conservation street. And it also links us to the past of that we once had and its beauty. But the proposed building is modern in its looks and materials all the way around. And it would, we feel that it will clash and affect badly on, you know, the Mellor Avenue conservation area and nearby streets. We think it's too high to be next to a heritage area in keeping with that. Also, there's another thing that with this heritage we'll see that, you know, the heritage street's appearance will see, you know, constant parking problems with the street filled, I fear, from the cars from the development.
Excuse me, Chair, that's 3 minutes.
Yes, that...
Okay, well, I've finished.
That is your 3 minutes, Mr. Pissarro.
Yep.
And we have to now move on to hear from the applicant. We have two speakers for the applicant, Mr. Sarkar and Mr. North. Who wishes to go first?
I'm quite happy to go first, Chair.
Yes, Mr. North.
Yes, Philip North here from Weir Phillips Heritage and Planning, the heritage consultants and planning consultants for the applicant.
We do have your written submission.
Yes, excellent. I'll summarise that very briefly, being mindful of the time. The application, of course, is recommended for refusal. The primary reason for that is Council's view that there's a lack of adequate information in respect of site isolation and demonstrating the unwillingness of the neighbours at 129 and 131 Norton Street to sell. Council requested additional information in terms of evaluation and formal offers and documentation of formal rejections. Council gave the applicant a deadline for submitting that, which I understand to be corrected on this was the 4th of December. That information was submitted to Council, indicating that providing valuation and a response from the neighbours, or at least one of the neighbours anyway, indicating that they were not willing to sell. And of course, those properties are only useful if both of them are sold together. If one of them is not sold, then of course the remaining site would be certainly be isolated. So council should have that information now. The other question I would raise is whether those sites could be considered genuinely to be isolated at all. The two sites together have a width of 16 metres. Under council's controls, there's no minimum site width for development of residential flat building. I have had approved and seen approved many residential flat buildings in the R3 zone on sites of less than 16 metres. In fact, had one recently approved in the last 12 months at 33 Gower Street, which was on a site 11.43 metres wide. And of course, council's DCP nominates a side setback of 2 metres, provided, of course, you satisfy the privacy objectives of the ADG, which can be done in a variety of ways, not necessarily using a 6 metre separation distance. Moving on to FSR, there's a suggestion in the report, council's report, that the FSR is non-compliant. This is because there's a misunderstanding that the front balconies are configured as winter gardens. That's actually not the case. I think it's a misreading of the rendering on the front of the drawing set. In fact, nowhere in the drawing set are they referred to as winter gardens. So, in fact, they are intended to be open. And if that's the case, then no non-compliance with FSR would arise. And the applicant's willing to accept a condition to that effect. In terms of the materiality, the original application did in fact provide face brickwork sympathetic to the conservation era. I think the reason it was changed was because there was a misunderstanding of council's feedback, but it could easily be changed back and the applicant once again would be willing to accept a condition to that effect.
Sorry, Chair, that's 3 minutes.
That's all right. We need to know the nature of the development. You proceed.
Well, thank you, Chair. Now, there's another issue raised in the officer's report regarding building separation of Building B, the one which faces Norton Street. This building has a 3-metre side setback on one side and 4-metre side setback on the other. Now, I'd note that the relevant part of the council's DCP requires a setback of two metres on the sides, provided, of course, that the objectives of the privacy requirements of the ADG are complied with. And, of course, that can be done by either providing a 6-metre separation distance or, and this has been accepted by the court on many occasions, by way of frosted windows or highlight windows or other strategies. I think there's concern that utilising these strategies would reduce the amenity of the apartments. Of course, they're only small apartments, so they only have one main room, which requires an outlook, which is the living room, and in all cases, these have an outlook either to the front or the rear, so that is either to the streetscape of Norton Street, which is comparatively pleasant, or to the rear, which is landscaped. So they have large balconies or relatively well-sized balconies with glass sliding doors and a very pleasant outlook. And the highlight windows would generally be only to bathrooms and kitchens and maybe one or two bedrooms. And look, I think those are the primary issues. But I would have thought that with application of several conditions to address some of these minor outstanding issues of materiality, this application would be readily approvable. Thank you.
Any questions from the panel? From the panel? No, from Ms. Morrill?
No, one else? Mr. Chair.
No, Mr. Johnson? No, we lost Mr. Johnson. We've lost a panel member.
No, sorry, I'm here. I was on mute. No, I don't have any questions.
No questions. All right.
No questions.
Good. Thank you for that, Mr. North. Thank you. Now, Mr. Sakhar.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Sakhar is just on mute. He might just need to unmute himself and he'll be right.
Yes, good afternoon, panel, ladies and gentlemen.
We can hear you and see you.
Can you hear me?
Yes, proceed.
Okay. Well, my name is Tony Silver, I'm the applicant. From our discussions with council and our correspondence, it seems that the main issue that council had with our proposal was that of site isolation and of the properties on Milton Street. And council had indicated that if we resolve the issue of site isolation, they would conditionally support our proposal. Our submission has been a difficult process. It involved six properties. There are six properties in question here, and these are detailed in our letter. The process started in 2014, where we tried to amalgamate all these six properties. By June 2018, we were able to amalgamate four of these properties, and the two other properties had indicated they were not interested in joining the process. So we started our design process in 2018. So it's been a sensitive, it's a sensitive site, we understand it's a sensitive site. We're trying to tick all the boxes and produce a good development and a good design. In July 2019, we had two pre-DA meetings with council and we launched our DA in 2020. In September 2020, Council gave us a formal response in which They gave us 21 days to submit additional information and amendments. But it actually took us 13 days before we could speak to anybody in council to find out exactly what was required. So that left us with 8 days virtually to comply with what council required. And that was physically impossible. We couldn't do exactly what council required us to do in the 8 days that was left. So what we did was we got a letter from one of the adjoining properties, and they said they were not interested in selling their property, and that's in attachment 1 and 2 that we've submitted. And we submitted this letter with our amended drawings and all the amended details in the time that was allowed to us by council. In October of this year, council got back to us and they said they were recommending the project refusal purely because, basically because, we didn't follow the planning principles. So we set out to resolve those issues. We got an evaluation of both properties on the 25th of November this year. That's attachment 3. We made formal offers to purchase these properties on the 25th of November. That's attachments 4, 5 and 6. But we got the same response from councils, from the owners, for our offers to purchase. That's attachments 7 and 8. In other words, the adjoining properties, they all said that they're not interested in selling. But we already proved that both those properties are not isolated and they can be developed.
Sorry, Chair, that's 3 minutes.
No, I'll let Mr. Sakhar finish. Please proceed.
But unfortunately, one of these remaining 4 properties, there's an option on it, and that option expires at the end of this year. But what have we achieved by amalgamating 4 properties for the development? We've actually created a very good pedestrian link between Ashfield West and the town centre by eliminating 2 new driveways on Liverpool Road. We've removed potential garbage piles on Liverpool Road and planning it on Wharton Street, which all of which is in the public interest. We've created an interesting transition between the taller buildings of Ashfield West and the town centre in the Heritage Conservation Area. We have actually submitted amended elevations on this with amended materials, which we hope that the panel has had a chance to review. And those address all the concerns that people have about the materials on Liverpool Road. And we're happy to make further amendments if required. Now, Mr. Chairman, we're living in a democracy. We can't force people to sell their properties if they don't want to. So we haven't really isolated these properties, but we've shown that we have produced a good development, and we're happy to make whatever further amendments are required to satisfy other people's requirements. Thank you very much, Chair.
Any questions from the panel? Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chair.
None from...
No, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Morrell, any questions? Have we lost Ms. Morrell?
She's on mute, Mr. Chair.
No, I was just on mute, but no, I was just shaking my head, sorry.
All right. There are being no questions. Thank you, Mr. Sakhar. What will happen now is that the panel will consider what's been put to us, and we will publish our determination in due course.
Mr. Chair, just before we move on, just one thing that I did notice and that we will do as part of the discussion was in relation to the neighbour notification technical requirements. I had some concerns around whilst this particular development meets the requirements that are prescribed under the notification requirements for development-related applications. That's under the community engagement framework. I feel that there may have been some parties who were affected by the application that did not fall within those prescribed limits. So as part of that, I would like just to note it for the public record that we may well make some recommendations around that. So ensuring that all those people, even if they fall outside the prescribed requirements, are notified appropriately of similar such developments.
Well, I concur, and that will be noted on any decision we make.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
That brings us to the next item, item number two. This is the proposed modification of an approved mixed-use building at 354 Canterbury Road, Hurlston Park, including an additional level and removal of a ground floor business premises tenancy. Again, we have a number of speakers on this matter. The first person I note is Jim Morris. Do we have Jim Morris available?
Yes. Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. And I don't know if you heard what I said earlier, but the protocol for these meetings allows members of the public, such as yourself, to address the panel for up to 3 minutes. And your 3 minutes starts now.
Thanks. I'm opposed to the proposed modification. As regards increased height of the building, the proposed 11th unit is almost entirely above the 13-metre allowable height. I don't know how the developer could expect this blatant disregard for the allowable building height to be approved. The rooftop lift access exceeds the limit in the approved plan for the 11th unit, but the 11th unit is way over the top and can't be approved, surely. Outdoor space for residents. Comparing page 10 of the plan with photographs I'd taken of the plan that was approved last February, I see an extraordinary reduction in rooftop open space for residents of units below, even though the proposed 11th unit extends further west and south than the approved open space. Other residents would be socialising almost at the 11th unit's living area. The 6 metre wide strip behind the childcare outdoor deck is their only other outdoor access. No private open space other than balconies, but even owner occupiers are restricted in what they can do with their balconies under strata title. A recent October indoors wet day confinement brought home to me the unreasonable pressures on families in apartments during lockdown. Given the uncertainty of future successive waves of COVID-19 and possible other future epidemics, the roof space for the 10 units already approved must remain unchanged for at least some relief from cabin sickness. Climate change, so convenient for transient politicians to deny, is a luxury available and unavailable to local government, which must manage ongoing on-the-ground reality and will face serious consequences for poor practices of the past. But this building, as approved, will have so little consideration for climate change. What roof area available for clean energy and greening must remain. There were 7 photovoltaic panels on the approved plan. The proposed modification has just 3 panels. In whose interest? In 1981 or 2, I had a solar architect look at my house and he said there was no improvements he could suggest other than to build a new house at the southeast corner, and strongly suggested I try to have the neighbour's consent to build on the fence line. By just looking at my neighbour's yard and its dimensions, the suggestion was grotesque. It told me architects how only the client's convenience in mind, not the neighbour's, because they're not paying the architect's fees. I see the same thinking in the past approved a development plan and now in the proposed modification. The interests of an absentee landlord are paramount in the architect's mind. Efforts to push past the limits regarding building height and the permissible amenity of residents are all over this proposed modification. Thanks very much.
All right, thank you for that. Now, next is Benjamin Black. Do we have Mr. Black here?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'm here. Can you hear me?
All right.
Yes.
Great. Okay. I'm here on behalf of the applicant. Were there other submitters that needed to go before me?
Well, matter for you. Who wants to go first?
No, I'm the only one for the applicant, sorry. I was just wondering whether there's any other residents.
Yes, okay. No, there are no more residents.
Okay, great.
The ball's in your court.
Thank you very much. I am running solo today. We did have someone else registered to speak, but that person's had to attend to a family matter. So,
is that Mr. Guerin?
That's correct, so no.
He's not available?
He's not.
Okay.
So I might ask the panel's leniency if I can steal a bit of his time, but maybe I won't need it. We'll see how we go.
See how we go, yes.
Okay, great. Thank you. All right. So thank you to the panel for the opportunity to discuss this proposal. Unfortunately, it is recommended for refusal, and I disagree with the assessment of council in several areas, and I think they are critical areas, and those critical areas have led to the refusal recommendation. So that the first main point in the report talks about permissibility, and what was originally approved on this site was a childcare centre at ground level with a small 40 square metre business space with units above. Now, the only permitted residential form of development on this site is achieved via the shop top housing definition, which is an additional permitted use on this site. So shop top housing definition means one or more dwellings located above ground level, retail premises or business premises. So with that narrow definition, the council has come to the conclusion that the change that we're seeking, which is to remove the business premises at the ground level and only maintain the childcare, would mean that the development becomes prohibited because a childcare centre, in council's view, is better described or best described as an educational establishment, not a business or retail premises. So on that front, we sought some legal advice from Mills Oakley planning lawyers, and we did intend, or I intended, or tried to submit that for the panel's review, but was informed that wasn't appropriate. So I'll try and paraphrase as best I can without reading the text what the advice concludes. I think it's accepted that this isn't a childcare centre, wouldn't be a retail premises. We haven't suggested that it would be, but our view is that it would be appropriately described as a business premises. A business premises is defined primarily as a professional occupation or a service provided directly to the members of the public on a regular basis. And it's our view that that second part of that definition, which is a service component, does relate to a childcare centre, which would make it a business use by definition. Now, as I say, the business premises definition states that it must be a service provided directly to the members of the public. Now, a service isn't defined in the LEP standard definitions. In the case of 7X Proprietary Limited and Blue Mountains Council, the court found that a service is plainly described as an act of helpful activity. That was also confirmed by Justice Sheehan on appeal, who also stated and furthered that statement of the court that different types of businesses can form that different helpful activity, and such businesses would commonly be found in most suburban areas. That is discussed at length in the legal advice, but to discuss very quickly for the panel's consideration, the definition of an educational establishment is narrowly defined in the LEP. It requires a building or place to be a school, a tertiary education facility, which should include a university or a TAFE. It doesn't state that it's a childcare centre or something of that nature or any form of care.
Excuse me, Chair, that's 3 minutes.
All right, we'll hear Mr.
Black.
Mr. Blackout.
Thank you. The advice from Mills Oakley goes on to say that unlike the definition for business premises under the Ashfield LEP, the definition for educational establishment as above is exhaustive rather than merely inclusive. It identifies only two types of places that may be defined as use as an education facility, a school or a tertiary institution. A childcare centre is neither. The legal advice also cites references for similar scenarios where a childcare centre at ground level has been used to create permissibility for shop top housing development. That includes a reference to Adgemis, spelled A-D-G-E-M-I-S, Adgemis Holdings Proprietary Limited versus Georges River Council. So on that basis, it's my respectful view that the modified proposal remains permissible in the zone, and it doesn't become prohibited because of the change that's being sought. There are two other primary points, I guess, raised in the council report. One is of LEP compliance, so that's heightened FSR. The report incorrectly references or draws I get the image in the report. It references and copies an image of the building and the amount of the building above the height limit, and it does so at page 117, figure 5. And it shows the penthouse level as being substantially a majority above the height limit. Now, that particular elevation, or it's actually a section CC, isn't drawn in the location of the penthouse. It's actually much further forward, and it's right up close to Watkins Street, some 10 or so metres forward of the penthouse. So we intentionally designed the penthouse to be no greater than the LEP height variation that was granted under the original DA, which was at a maximum of 1.9 metres. So the roof of the building actually slopes to match the natural topography as it falls under the site. The better section to look at is section EE, which if the panel is able to look at the architectural plan set, perhaps now or later on, you'll see that the section is drawn through the unit itself, and it shows much less of the unit above that height limit. So, again, it's my respectful submission that the council has erred in its consideration of the proposed building height. Similarly, there has been an issue raised with FSR. Now, we have checked this and checked it again, and we are of the view that we're compliant with the FSR of 1.5:1. We would have liked the opportunity to perhaps go back to council and discuss that further, but the application was placed on your agenda for a decision before we could do so. Side issues are also raised relating to the ADG. There is an incorrect assessment in the analysis of common open space. It makes the statement that we're using part of the street front entryway as common area, but we're not in any way. And there's a common open space diagram submitted with the plans, which clearly shows that we're using a combination of the rooftop and the space, the deep soil zone, which stretches along the rear of the site between our subject site and the neighbours, closest neighbours on Watkins Street. That is the same as what was approved already in the existing DA. What we have done on the rooftop to accommodate the penthouse is massage the space, but essentially provide the same quantum of floor area on the roof in a different format and with just as good amenity with a variety of spaces as you'll see on the plan. There's a side issue raised on the privacy impacts from the rooftop or the penthouse balcony space. But it's our view that has no privacy impact on anyone. It actually looks onto and over the neighbouring site, which is a much lower scale building. There is no overlooking or direct look into anyone's private area, and certainly no more than what the units are already approved would allow for. The penthouse isn't visible from the street frontages, and you can see that from... I've provided some additional views to the panel secretary, which provided three views, approved view of the building from the street and then proposed as amended. And they clearly show the different viewpoints. The first plan shows three different viewpoints, two on Canterbury Road, one from Watkins Street, and the before and after effect. And the penthouse isn't visible. So claims and statements in the report that this will create an inconsistency or a visual obstruction or a character issue on Canterbury Road or other street frontages is incorrect in our view, because it just simply won't happen with the location of the penthouse. It goes further to that, what I was just talking about with the location and the impacts and the visibility. Obviously, with that lack of visibility comes a lack of privacy and overshadowing impacts. There has been no amenity impact connected with this penthouse in the report that is beyond what's already approved or even significant or material in any way. So with that, it's my respectful view that the refusal recommendation isn't warranted and the application is better approved.
Any questions from the panel?
No, thank you.
Mr. Johnson? Where's Mr. Johnson?
No questions.
Ms. Roche, any questions?
No, thanks, Mr. Chair.
All right. Again, thank you for that, Mr. Black.
Okay, thank you for your time.
And as with the other matter, we will consider what's been put to us and publish a determination in due course. So that brings us to item three. Item three is the proposed demolition of a building within Callan Park. Is Megan Park here from the department?
Yes, I'm here with my manager, Sarah Cameron.
We can hear you, but we... Oh, there you are. All right. Do you wish to say anything?
We provided a statement. Would you like us to repeat the statement, the written statement?
We have the written statement.
Yeah.
It's a statement with which I totally disagree. You've asserted that this panel does not have jurisdiction to determine the application. That's the essence of it, as I understand.
Correct. That's the department's position.
I have to tell you that I disagree for the following reasons. The provision under which we operate, section 4.82 of the Environmental Planning and Assessment Act, post-dates the Callan Park Act. Where you have two provisions which are inconsistent with one another, the later provision prevails. If you go to the later provision, section 4.82 of the Environmental Planning and Assessment Act, it says the functions of a council as a consent authority are not exercisable by the councillors. They are exercisable on behalf of the council by the local planning panel. What you seem to be suggesting, therefore, is that there is no consent authority at all for this proposal. However, I don't agree with that proposition either. When one considers the principles of statutory interpretation, including the provision that a later contrary provision prevails over an earlier provision, the courts try and read the two provisions together. And if it's possible, then one would try and make it work so that they both read as subject to the other. In my view, the provision in the Callan Park Act is subject to section 4.82 of the Environmental Planning and Assessment Act, which means that we are the consent authority. And that's the way I rule. Do you have any comment on that?
I'll just restate the position of the department, which is that the effect of section 7.2 of the Callan Park Act is that the Inner West Local Planning Panel could not act as a consent authority for development applications relating to land within Callan Park, as it would undermine the clear intention of the legislature in section 7.2 of the Act, which ensures that council is the relevant consent authority to determine all DAs relating to the land within the Callan Park.
Well, I have to say I've also consulted Professor Dennis Pierce, the guru on statutory interpretation, who is a former colleague of mine on the academic staff at ANU, and he concurs with my opinion. So I reject your assertion. We are the consent authority. We will deal with it.
Okay. Thank you.
All right.
And Chair, can I just ask, is there any comments, apart from the question of who determines this application, is the department's in favour of it, I assume, of the recommendation?
Well, it's their application. Yeah.
Yes, well, that's what I mean. Yes, I'm just trying to make sure that I understand where your position is. Good, great.
Okay, thank you.
Anyway, for the reasons that I've very briefly outlined, and I could have gone into the case law in depth if you'd like, we will determine the application, and I am of the firm view that we have authority to do it and no one else does. All right, so we will, there being no opposition, we will adopt the recommendation and grant consent. So that should keep you happy, I think. All right.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you for your attendance. Good. So then that brings us to the development in Mansfield Street, Roselle. This is the proposed fit-out of units for the purpose of an artisan food and drink industry with ancillary office, which was recommended for refusal. There is a number of speakers on this matter, and the first speaker we have is the Mayor of Inner West, Councillor Byrne.
G'day, Chair. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear.
Excellent. Thanks very much. Not often that I get to see you twice in 1 week, so thank you very much for the opportunity. As you know, I'm really completely removed from the development assessment process, but I have read the report and the recommendation that has been tabled for consideration of the panel. I just wanted to highlight a couple of important points. Firstly, we've really got this problem with all of the microbreweries that have been opening up across the Inner West. There's a lot of grey area, and it's difficult to interpret exactly what the definition is of ancillary use. We know that the business model depends upon having a wholesale business with a retail component. And I've spent a lot of time talking to local breweries because they're such important local employers. And across the board, they all say that just about their biggest challenge is trying to get consent to operate in the way that every microbrewery would. The government recognised that this was both a significant industry or emerging industry and also a significant planning challenge, which is why they introduced a trial only in the Inner West, I think. I can't recall. It's almost 2 years ago now, I think, that they introduced it to try to come to terms with this and have I think it was called artisan food and drink on premise as an ancillary use that's allowable for this type of business. I'm not aware of a single application that has been successfully approved under that trial. So whilst we welcomed it and obviously are on the same page as the government, there's still an issue that the planning controls were written and devised at a time when no one knew what a microbrewery was. In this instance, we've got an application from a brewery that's already operating its wholesale component. In fact, they've set up during COVID. They opened in March, which is a pretty difficult time, I think, to undertake a new business such as this. And they've been very warmly welcomed by the local community. In fact, their beer is on tap in most local pubs that I'm aware of. More importantly, there's not a single submission that's been received by council in opposition, or a single submission of any kind in relation to the application. None in opposition. Now, none from local residents. I think you've all been panellists and involved in planning issues long enough in this local community to know that if there was something that was going to have a significant impact on the amenity of people living in Roselle or Balmain, you'd get a few submissions. You'd get lots of submissions. There's also no submission from the police. Now, the police, certainly in Newtown, as a matter of course, make a submission against any new licensed premises or expansion of trading hours on the basis that they think that Newtown's already at capacity. So it's certainly the standard practice of police in the Inner West to make submissions against the opening of new premises, or at least to draw to the attention of the panel and the council their concerns about safety. But they've raised none here. So given the very large scale investment that's taken place in setting the business up, and the significant investment they've made in presenting consultants' reports in preparation of this application, obviously not to the satisfaction of the council officers given the recommendation, but it's not something that they've not made a good faith attempt at. I think it would be very good if there was a trial of some kind that was able to be undertaken rather than just refusing the application. I don't think it's going to be of a great deal of use or in my view, particularly fair to simply refuse the application but say we're open to receiving a new application. That would ignore the reality of the financial strain that the business will be under. So if there are options available to the panellists to be able to take up some of the concerns that council officers, have identified and have them addressed through a trial period, then I would like to really strongly encourage you to do that, because I think the benefits for our local economy and our local community of this business being able to succeed are overwhelming. Thanks very much, Chair.
Councillor, we are given to understand that there are similar establishments, artisan food and drink premises in the Marrickville area. Are you aware of that?
Yeah, yep, 14 at last count.
Yes. And presumably they operate under this same provision, under this new definition of artisan food and drink industry.
No, that's not right. They've all had to go through various methods of approval. None of them have been successful. As far as I know, none of them have been successful in making use of the government's trial definition.
I see. All right. Any other questions from the panel? I'm getting...
Thanks, Mr. Chair. All good.
No, all not good. From me. No.
All thanks right. very much for your time.
Good. Thank you for that.
Thank you. Thank
you. Next, is Christopher Brown available?
I am, Chair.
Where are you? I don't see you. I hear you, but don't see you.
I'm often best consumed that way, Chair.
I can see you now. All right. So.
Thank you very much. May I first start by congratulations to the panel. I addressed the panel on Tuesday, and I believe since then that support has been given for the Fenwick for nighttime trading. So this is part of my, I suppose, crusade on behalf of the Peninsula Partnership, the community group, to bring life back to the peninsula for a place that has sadly lost a lot of its mojo in recent years, and also to Mayor Byrne for his personal crusade to try and overcome some of our neighbours to let us enjoy life. I speak in support of the application because, again, here's another group of local entrepreneurs with a modest request to try and add that certain sense of enlivenment to the community without threatening in any way planning codes, without threatening the very nature, the fabric of our community. I, for one, was part of a campaign to introduce the lockout laws some years ago when publicans were out of control in our city. So I'm not some necessary alcohol spokesman if I've been on the other side, but this is now the right application at the right time in the right place for the right product. There's been a rebirth of the craft beer movement in the Inner West. It hasn't led to the wholesale destruction of communities. It hasn't led to violence and alcoholism. What it has led to is place appropriate soft tread tourism and activation of the community. Balmain's been left out of that, unlike Newtown, Marrickville, Annandale, etc. It had its attempt with the Balmain Beer Company, which went under because it couldn't get local premises. Finally, through the work of the White Bay Beer Company, they've secured that. They've secured it in a location that has minimal residential impact and at the right time. And my only complaint was I'd probably want them to go a little larger. It's a very modest application they have, and I'm happy to support that because if that's what the community is comfortable with. But in supporting and the written submission I made, it really is important, like the Fenwick decision, that we get some momentum. I am frankly ashamed when I drive down Darling Street on a Tuesday night and the place is dead. Everything is closed. And that's pre-COVID. Everything is closed. We need to get jobs going again in hospitality. We need to bring people back in the right way. We're not talking beachside resorts and massive taverns. There's a very modest hospitality addition to a manufacturing business. And in that way, and I think proudly on behalf of our community group, which reflects both business and community, that there seems to be overwhelming support for modest proposals like this that can give a bit of life back to our once vibrant community that is in great danger of eating itself.
Any questions from the panel?
No, thank you.
No, thanks, Mr. Chair.
No, not from me either.
All right.
Thank you, Chair. Good thank luck you. And Godspeed in deliberations.
Next is Adam Tripp-Smith.
Hi, Mr. Chair. I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, and we have your written material.
Excellent. Thank you. So just look, I won't get into the plan intricacies. There's plenty of people online to do so. I'm one of the founders of White Bay Beer Co. I think we are the only brewery that launched during COVID, during the lockdowns. We couldn't have picked a worse year to launch, but here we are. So we've survived the first 6 months. The four founders all have backgrounds in the beer game, different skill sets in terms of hospitality, sales, brewers, et cetera, et cetera. Since we launched in March, we've created 8 jobs, all of them living in the inner west. I myself live in Balmain and have for a while. My wife's born and bred in Balmain. There's obviously, as we've discussed with Darcy, a huge amount of breweries in the inner west. There's none in Balmain. And for many years, my partners and I have been driving by those warehouses in White Bay, waiting for one to come available. And as you all know, they're very tightly held. And we were just lucky that in the same month, 2 became available and we jumped on it and moved in. Our rent is well over $30,000 a month. And that's a big rent bill to pay for a small brewery that has launched during COVID. So we do need to sell more beer. And we are first and foremost a production brewery. We are looking to supplement that with a small hospitality offering, which will complement what we do in producing beer. In a short space of time of 6 months, our beer is pretty much available statewide. And we've had an application obviously running that you're now going to opine on since March to add to our facility there in White Bay. There's been no objections to our application from residents, as you've heard. Just about every pub on the peninsula pours our beer. We are in Woolworths and the Coles Liquor Groups within our first 6 months, as well as close to 100 independent bottle shops. So as far as the launch of a brewery has gone, full stop, it's been pretty outstanding. When you add in COVID on top of that, it really is a great feat by the team. But we don't win a kick and own goal here and not be able to have people visit our brewery, learn about what we're doing, see where it's made, try it, buy it, and walk away and tell their friends to go and have a look at it. We don't want to compete with our pubs. If we would do that, we'd be shooting ourselves in the foot and the pubs wouldn't pour our beer. So we're here to complement everything in hospitality on the peninsula and welcome the community into our venue. And this is not to be a small bar or anything like that. This is to be a family-friendly venue where people come in, experience what we do, walk away happy, and bring people to the community. So thank you for listening.
Any questions from the panel?
Can we just clarify, the hours of operation that you're seeking?
Yeah, I'll let David handle all of that because he's submitted a second letter clarifying all that. So right. David, our planner, is online and he'll touch base on that.
No other questions? All right, then we'll move on to the planner. Is David there? David?
Yep. Hello. Can you all hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Chair.
I should remind you that we do have your written submission.
Yes, thank you very much. There was a supplementary submission that we tried to get in front of you, but that was a little bit too late this morning to try and get in. The only additional matter to address was trading hours. So I'll turn to that first. Just as an introduction, my name is Dave Griffengill. I'm the Director of Design Collaborative. I've got a Bachelor of Environmental Planning and a Juris Doctor. So turning to trading hours first, there was an error when a supplementary strata consent was provided where the hours were extended across Monday to Thursday between 10 p.m. and midnight. That was inadvertent. And obviously those hours haven't been notified to the community. So that wasn't intentional and we're happy to withdraw that part of the application to avoid any issues in that regard. I guess the biggest ticket item is permissibility. As Darcy Byrne noted, there's a bit of a grey area and confusion regarding what is an artisan food and drink industry. You heard Adam discuss the extensive level of off-premise sales through the Woolworths Liquor Group and through the pubs in Balmain, which in my mind very easily satisfies the principal purpose of the artisan food and drink industry, which is to manufacture boutique artisan or craft food and drink products. That is their primary purpose. And also, in order to meet the other half of the definition, you also must include at least one of the following, being a retail area for the sale of products, So we have a bar area. We clearly meet that. A restaurant or cafe, we've proposed to do that. We meet that. And facilities for holding tasting, tours and workshops. You heard Adam talk about that, and that is their intention to do that. In my mind, this is clearly within the definition. I know council had some concerns regarding the scope of, I think, the first floor office premises and the scope of the restaurant bar area. But it is clearly intended not to, that's not intended to be the primary purpose of the operation. So I think it clearly satisfies it in that regard. Turning to some of the other issues that were raised in council's report, they had a concern regarding that we hadn't addressed social impact in sufficient depth. A supplementary report was provided to council on that. It was not a full social impact assessment, but it was fairly detailed for the application being proposed. I regularly prepare social impact assessments for new pubs. I think it was appropriate in scope and adequately addresses the potential for impact in that regard. And the conclusion was that it would have positive impact on the local community, which I think you've seen reflected in the comments from Darcy and Chris Brown. Regarding the ancillary office premises, council originally had an issue because the extent of the office premises proposed exceeded the 10% limit set in the DCP. That, of course, has the limit set in the DCP as to what is considered ancillary with a quantifiable measurement is not the basis on how you would assess whether something is ancillary or not. But notwithstanding, it has been reduced. It now equates to 10.25% of the total floor area. The office premises is intended primarily to serve the brewery. It's going to be their head office, their sales, their advertising and promotion centre. Regardless if it's slightly over that 10% limit, we still consider it to be ancillary. If the panel was to disagree with that, we'd be happy to drop that 0.25% somewhere, and that could be achieved via a condition of consent to be satisfied prior to CC.
Excuse me, Chair, that's 3 minutes.
No, we're going to let Mr. Rippingill.
Yep. I just have one last issue to talk about, and that is the traffic and parking. There is BCA accessibility and fire safety, but I'll leave Christopher Grinham, our architect, to talk to those matters. With traffic, our calculations originally excluded the brewery, as that was a component that had already been approved under CDC. We've re-included that in our parking calculations. And based on those, our calculations against council's controls are that there's a shortfall of 1.2 spaces between 9 a.m. and 4 p.m. And that 4 p.m. is just the way that the trading hours are proposed. That's a very limited shortfall in the context of most applications. We say that shortfall during the day is acceptable because during the day, people take their cars and drive to work, freeing up daytime parking spaces. This is a very common finding for traffic and parking reports that was then supported by a traffic and parking consultant who agreed with that that position. And further to that, we did actually, I sent someone down to White Bay Brewery to survey the streets yesterday. We did just try to get this survey in front of you this morning, but I was unable to. Within 200 metres, we'd found 10, 20, 35, 45 spaces on three streets within 200 metres, and there's another four streets that we could have surveyed that we didn't. So we can provide that to you later, but clearly there's more than ample on-street parking to deal with a very minor shortfall during the day. And that is the end of my submission, if anybody has any questions.
Any questions, panel?
Just through you, Mr. Chair. Is it also your intention, though, that a number of the, given the placement of the location, that you'll have a number of the local people walking to your venue as well?
Yes,
rather correct. Than driving, given the nature of the venue and what you're trying to achieve?
Exactly. I would expect a lot of people would arrive by Uber or public transport as well.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Yes. No questions from me. Thank you for the answer to that one.
Okay. Mr. Grinham, please.
I'm hoping you've got me there. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Now, before you start, we have been furnished with some amended plans.
Yes.
One is said to be version 12, dated the 7th of December. Another is said to be version 7, dated 19th of November. Are they the plans you now rely upon?
They are. You would note from the revision numbers that there's been quite a few amendments made to the drawings over the period of time in which this application has been before council. It is not for want of trying that we have been engaging with council staff to, I guess, mitigate in a lot of ways council officers' of concerns with respect to the application. One thing that has worried me through this process, and I think in some respects I have to put my hand up and take some responsibility, is that the application is for a bar that has a total value of about $250,000 to $300,000 as construction cost. When the council bought in the provisions for an artisan food and beverage producer, it was the intention was to try and alleviate the concerns and the complexity of approvals for these sorts of businesses in the Inner West. And to find that at the end of a 9-month process, my clients have expended in excess of $85,000 to $90,000 in consultants' reports for a bar with a total grand cost of $300,000 is really difficult to accept. I'm not trying to, for one second, downplay the importance of proper assessment and of understanding the implications and the impacts on the neighbouring community. But within 2 weeks of lodging the application, we understood we had no objections from that community. In fact, we did have some support from that community for this sort of operation in this location. We have worked diligently and as hard as we can to inform the council and try to deal with their concerns. I mean, with respect to parking, one other thing I did want to add was a brewery is a large facility that is not staff intensive. Council's parking controls are based on square metre rates, not on staff numbers. And to that point, I think it's important to realise that as much as a brewery is a very, very large facility, it will run with two or three people. It's a state-of-the-art facility. Our clients, and I'm not sure this has been mentioned, but I don't want to downplay it. They've made a $3 million investment in the brewery infrastructure as it stands. They will be able to run that facility with two or three staff members on site. It is not going to be producing a huge number of parking requirements. The other thing to bear in mind is that we've purposely opened the ancillary bar when the majority of the other light industrial uses in that facility in the greater development are closed, so that we can alleviate the concern on the requirement for parking in the complex. So we've been working very closely with the strata manager and with the owner of the building to make sure that happens. One other thing I do just quickly want to touch on, as David mentioned to me, is that we have supplied a BCA fire and accessibility report. City plan have recommended a number of changes which have been implemented into the drawings which you have in revision 12. We're more than happy to accept some of the conditions of consent with respect of what city plan have recommended and have that form part of our conditions of consent. I think after all the time we've spent on this project and with the passion that my clients have for what they're trying to produce down there, I think it would be an awful shame if this application was to fail, because I don't think, as I say, given we've had absolutely no community objection in an area which in my 25 years of doing what I do is a very rare thing to have no community objection to an application of this nature. So to me, that speaks volumes of the community support for what we're trying to achieve. I do hope that the panel sees fit to recommend approval, and I thank you very much for your time.
Any questions from the panel? Mr. Johnson?
No, nothing from me. Thank you.
Ms. Morrell?
I'm nodding my head. No, thank you. Thank you.
Ms. Roach?
I'm right. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
All right. So as with the other matters, we will consider what's been put to us and publish our decision in due course. And we thank you all for your input. And just to clarify again, Mr. Grinham, it's the two amended plans that were sent to us today that you're relying upon now.
Correct.
Correct. Okay, thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, I can I add to that? It's also the new plan of management that came in today, noting that there'd need to be some changes for timings, which related to timings. I think they went to midnight and that would need to be changed to 10 p.m., et cetera. So it was also the new plan of management that came in as well. I just want to check. That's right, isn't it, David or Chris?
That is correct.
Thank you.
Yeah, the 10 p.m. is the time.
Yeah. And sorry, Mr. Chair, just one more thing. Chris, was there anything else that changed in that plan of management of significance between the one we had previously and the one that came in today?
It's purely tidying up that one small oversight on the hours.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks for that, Chris.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you very much for that.
Thank you very much.
So we can now move on to item number 5, 83 James Street, Leichhardt. This comprises alterations and additions to the first floor of each of three adjoining townhouses. We have a speaker from 81 James Street. Two speakers from 81 James Street, Luke Strett and Jilly Strett. Do we have those people here?
Yes, I'm here.
All right. You can proceed.
Okay, so we live at 81, which is, can you see me? Can you see me now?
Yes, loud and clear.
But you can't see me, right?
No, but we can hear you. That's important.
Okay. We live in an east-west facing building with along the southern side, we have three bedrooms and a bathroom. Along the northern side, we have basically an open plan living with two big rooms. There, the northern part is our living area, and it's a kitchen and dining area in the end, and a living room on the western end. Three windows, and the kitchen area has two windows, and we depend very much on the solar access from these two windows, these five windows, in fact. So the window in question, I think, is the window number three, working from the west to the east. So there's no question that no one's trying to refute that this window will be shadowed by the new development at 83A. The problem is what we use the room for, and what we use the room for is for, living. And we have two young children living here, 6 and 9, and this whole area is very much used for the things that recreation and the things that kids need to do. So if we were to lose our sunlight, it would be a very unfortunate, very sad thing for us. In principle, I have no objection to my neighbours wanting to expand their living space. It's just that it would be at our cost. It would be an irrevocable depreciation in our solar access and to the main living area. And it's an asset for them, but and permanent loss for us. Living space, they're number 83 on the first of the three, or the third of the three townhouses, has been able to find another way of building underground, I think. That's really our position.
Do those living areas have rooms to either the front or rear?
Yes. They have a door to the west and a door to the east.
When you say door...
Door going out onto... I've actually got a photograph here, but unfortunately you can't see me and I'm not sure why. Maybe I can find a way to...
No, I can't see you.
Start the video. Here. Oh, no, that's not it. Okay. Oh, and now yes, there we are.
Now I can see you. Can you hold it up?
Okay.
So the door at the far end of the room we're looking at leads to the outside backyard, does it?
Yes. Yes, right. The backyard, and that's through the kitchen. So I'm actually standing in the living room and we're looking through the kitchen out to the backyard.
I see.
And this is...
Now we seem to be losing you. All right. Well, you've had your 3 minutes. Now...
We would lose the light from is this one. So this window here that you see next to the fireplace, that would be completely obstructed by this, you know. And also we have solar panels that would also lose their light. So we depend very much on our solar panels. Sorry, I interrupted you.
That's all right. I'll ask the panel. Any questions from the panel?
No, thank you.
No, thanks, Mr. Chair.
No, sorry. I do have one. So the door to the outside. What direction does that face?
We have a door at each end of the building. So there's one going to the east, which is our backyard, and one going to the west, which is our front yard.
Okay, from that same room.
No, because it's a kitchen and living room with kitchen and living area. With one wall between.
Okay. And so the door to the backyard, what direction is that facing?
East.
East, okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you.
All right. No more questions? Does Luke Strait want to speak as well?
I have nothing to add. My wife already mentioned all the important points.
All right, thank you very much. Is Chris Jordan here?
Yes, I am, sorry. Chair?
All right, the ball's in your court, Mr. Jordan.
I'd just like to refer the panel to the shadow elevations submitted with the revised documentation. There is another north-facing window in that living kitchen area and a skylight, which is much larger than the affected window. So we don't have any impact on the large living room window facing north or the skylight in midwinter. And I think the impact on the solar panels are also extremely minor, only occurring at between 2 and 3 p.m. in midwinter, which is the time when there's not much going on with the solar panels anyway. There was a modification lodged to the... We did lodge amended drawings, which improved the solar impact, or reduced the solar impact to that kitchen window in dispute. That's all we've got to say, really. There's the north-facing living room window and the east-facing doors mean that there's more than adequate solar access to the living room of that dwelling, as well as through the skylight. The reasons for our proposal in the townhouses is to improve the amenity of all of them. They're all three bedroom basically terraces, and the second and third bedrooms are all very small, only single bedrooms really. So the small amount of extra floor space on each of the terraces is to improve the amenity of and usability of those three terraces with some slightly increased bedroom space and study space.
Any questions from the panel?
No, thank you.
No, not from me.
No.
Mr. Chair, can I just ask clarify one thing, please?
Yes, proceed.
We just heard from Chris that our living room is not being affected, but it actually is, because there's three north-facing windows in the main living area, and two of them were already impacted by the existing building, but the addition, the third one, which is now the one that gets the most of the light in midwinter, will be totally blocked and will have no sunshine whatsoever in midwinter. And this is our main living area. I'm not talking about the kitchen and the dining area.
All right. I think, Chris, can I just say this, Chris? I think you've called the kitchen window what we are calling the living room window. So I don't know if you can see this. No.
Yes, I can see it.
Anyway, basically, you make it sound very unimportant, but if you really look at those shadow drawings, you'll find that they totally obscure at least three of our windows, at least some of the time during that winter period, as well as significantly they cast shadow over the solar panels. And I would like to also add that in those three buildings, the building in 83A has three bedrooms, albeit small, but they have one adult child and one mother. In the middle room, the middle house, there is just one single woman living. In the third one, they have made themselves a very large underground living area. So it's not really critical that they expand. In fact, they've got, I mean, one person has three bedrooms and two people have three bedrooms with plenty of space downstairs. I think it's something that they desire rather than something they need. Whereas we really need the sunshine. We really need, you know, solar access. It's absolutely a critical thing to have. And once it's gone, we've lost it.
All right, that is noted. And if there's no more comments, as with the other matters, we'll consider what's been put to us.
Chair, can I just ask, should we allow the applicant's representative architect to respond, which is normally what we would do?
Thank you. Sorry, I dropped off at the end there.
Is that
okay for me to speak, Chair?
The comment from the neighbour was that the north-facing window will have no sunlight penetration whatsoever in midwinter. That's the comment.
Yes. Well, as the shadow diagrams show, that there's another window in that room and a skylight, which means the application, the impact of the solar, the application on solar access, it still more than meets the requirements of the DCP, meaning that the room along with the east facing glazed doors at the rear and the skylight and the larger north facing living room window means that the room is getting solar access for more than the required time.
Well, what we will do is we will look at the shadow diagrams carefully and come to our own
conclusion.
All right, if there's nothing else, we can move on.
I'm really sorry, but I just want to say, I just feel that Chris is trying to define and describe how we use our living space. The truth is that we are very cheek and jowl against 83 and 79. 79 has had a building application or has had a development that has completely taken our sky, and now 83 is preparing to do the same thing, we really have to have some space and some light. I can see from all of your photograph, all of your videos, that you all have plenty of light in your rooms. We want light too.
Anyway, as I said, we will consider look carefully at the shadow diagrams and then determine the matter on that basis.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right. So we can now move on to item number six. This is the Haberfield Library recommended. This is for modifications to approved works at the Haberfield Library, recommended for approval. It comes to the panel because the council is the applicant and landowner, and there is no problem with it. I do not think we need to hear from the planning consultant. Does the panel wish to hear from anyone on this one?
No, thank you, Chair.
No?
I'm satisfied, thank you.
No?
I don't think so.
No, thanks.
All right. So with that will be formally approved, there being no objections to it. So then we move on to Albany Street, Albany Road, Stanmore. This is 209, 215 and 217. Proposed additions at the rear of each of those properties. We have the owner of each of those properties wishing to speak. Firstly, I'll go to number 217 first, number 9. Chanel Jacob. Is Chanel Jacob here? Do we have Chanel Jacob? If not, 217 has been recommended for approval. And I'm just wondering whether she has any objections to any of the conditions.
Mr. Chair, this is Tina speaking. One of the mobile numbers that's connected to this Zoom meeting is the phone number for Chanel. I might just see if I can ask her to unmute. There we go.
Thank you very much. Sorry, I was speaking, but you couldn't hear me. My apologies. Yes, I'm here to represent my property and just go through any questions that you might have. But basically, what I'm trying to do is propose a garage to accommodate my car and a visitor's car in the backyard of my property, because I'm the only house in that section that doesn't have a garage. And I'd like to be able to put two cars in the back of my property, which is a 6-metre-wide property at the back of my lane, and proposing a new studio room above the garage. It will consist of a small bathroom, and it's a single room, so it's large enough to fit a double bed and some storage cupboards. The building is a heritage, is a double-storey building. It's a Victorian terrace. I have 3 children in the property, and we could do with having the additional space for storage and other elements above the garage. The building is designed within the standards, the minimum standards in terms of height, with bulk head and scale. The proposed roof will be a traditional 2-way pitched, powder-coated, corrugated iron metal deck roof. The external walls above the garage, they will be painted, select weatherboards, and the garage walls will be constructed from painted and rendered concrete blocks sitting on a new RC slab. I just want to find out if there's anything that the council committee needs further to approve this proposing.
Ms. Jacob, you're aware that there's a recommendation for approval here. Are you happy with the proposed conditions of approval?
Yes.
All right. That's all we needed to know.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So now I think we will hear from Paul Giles of 209 Albany Road.
Thank you, Chair. I appreciate the opportunity. I think by this long meeting, I think we'd all be rather down at the microbrewery at White Bay, but we'll press on. Our plan is recommended for not approval. This has been a fairly long-going issue with Inner West Council. There's a number of issues: excessive floor space, bulk and scale, the built form and design, and particularly around the heritage conservation. So I'll deal with each of those issues in turn, if I may. The first, in relation to the FSR, one advice that I have from our architect is that the Inner West Council has incorrectly calculated the revised floor space that was provided in our revised plans that were submitted to council. Council's purporting that it's 17% over the limit. This is not correct according to our plans, and that's DA 11. The floor space proposes only barely 10% over the limit, which by our understanding is acceptable by the Inner West Council. The second point in relation to bulk and scale: the bulk and scale is very consistent with existing built properties and properties currently being constructed along Buds Lane, Lorna Lane, and another laneways in Stanmore. And there's significant consistencies with our property 205 Albany Road, 215 Albany Road, 217 Albany Road, 211 and 203 Albany Road, all of which are in the same bulk and scale as our proposed plans. So we think that there is a inconsistency with the council's guidelines and the way that they're actually applying those to the bulk and scale of the building. What's more, in our revised plans, the bulk was substantially reduced in line with conversations that our architect had with the Inner West Council planners, and they requested the scale to be reduced to a certain level, which we understood we had adhered to. So it seems unusual that then we're in a position now where council is saying that the bulk and scale is not acceptable. So we were taking guidance from council officials. Again, the built form is once again consistent with the built surroundings. There is new buildings facing Buds Lane on the corner of Lorna Lane, which appear inconsistent with the other buildings along Buds Lane. There's new buildings that are being built that are bulky and appear way over the FSR. And my neighbour at 215, who you will hear from next, has also provided a significant number of photos to this effect. Finally, there's the issue of heritage. This is arguably not consistent within our area. It is quite simple to walk around all of our laneways within Stanmore and see buildings that do not meet the requirements the council have laid out for us to say that they need to meet the heritage guidelines. Again, I provided one example, which hopefully the committee has before them, of a property at Temple Street, which is a big square box that sits in the middle of the back lane of a new property. And that is acceptable to council, and yet the building that we are proposing to do is not, and we have been asked to provide consistency with pitch roots in the area, which there are very few. So I'm happy to provide further evidence to council, but thank you very much for your time.
Any questions from the panel?
No, not at this stage.
No, Mr. Chair.
None. All right, thank you for that. Next, we will hear from Milan Milosevic.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and apologies in advance for any background noise. Very similar to Mr. Giles on 209 Albany Road, the four points of rejection which were raised by council, no objections raised by neighbours at all in relation to our development application. But in relation to those matters raised by council, there were four items being bulk scale, lack of sympathy for the local area, the floor space ratio, and the conservation issues. So if I go through each of those individually, similar to Mr. Giles, around the bulk and scale, my DA is consistent with the built environment along Buds Lane. Please refer to my A4 page supplement in response to the objection on the original DA. I've reduced the height substantially in the revised DA, and the overall height is less than other built structures in Buds Lane. In relation to the council's comment around lack of sympathy in design, my proposed design will add amenity and provide an acceptable level of good design to the overall area. I've engaged with professional architects and designers here, so overall this structure will be a positive addition to the area. In relation to the floor space ratio, the planner has incorrectly quoted a figure of 17% in excess of FSR. My proposal is just on over 10% over the permitted FSR ratio. This is consistent with other applications that have been approved, e.g. 217 Albany Road. So from my perspective, the building is, you know, not in excessively in excess of the FSR ratio and consistent with other structures in the area. It should be noted to the panel, Mr. Chair, that I'm building on top of an existing garage structure. In no way am I extending the footprint of the structure with this development application whatsoever. The fourth and last point that was raised by council was around conservation issues. I've submitted photos to the panel of developments that are within a 300 metre diameter from my property. And in particular, I point the panel's attention to One Buds Lane, which is directly behind my garage. My home has been meticulously renovated with regard to conservation consideration back in 2012, and I'm disappointed that the local planner at council has raised this as an issue. From the street structure on Albany Road, none of the back area that's proposed for development is whatsoever visible. So from my perspective, I think that this application should be changed from rejected to approved. And again, I'd like to thank the panel for their time in listening to my concerns raised in response to the planner's objections. So thank you.
Questions from the panel? Any?
No, thank you.
Mr. Chair, just for this gentleman, because he is part of his submission, he did put in a series of photographs of similar ones. Just 205 Albany Road there, Mr. Milancevic. How long has that property been in that? Because that's very, well, similar. It's not the same, but similar in nature. How long has that development been in place there?
That's been there since about 2013 or 14. So roughly about five or six years. Okay. So I've lived at 215, just for context. I've lived there for 15 years since 2006.
Yeah.
No, thank you. Fine.
Thank you for that.
Thank you.
I have a couple of questions that really are directed to Mr. Milosevic and Mr. Giles from the adjoining properties, not the adjoining properties, for number 209 and number 215 Albany Road. Your designs are fairly similar. Are you both listening to me at the moment? I'm assuming you're both.
Correct. Yes. Yes, yeah, sir.
Okay, good. Thank you. I think I'm correct in saying both of you had discussions or correspondence with council back in September this year, requesting that the structures that you are proposing should be more akin to a loft above a garage, which is, I think it's in part 44.1.75 of the DCP, which council are suggesting. And one of the reasons by the officers for suggested refusal is that the form is not that of a loft structure above either of your garages. Yet the owner of number 9 has actually provided a proposal which complies with that concept of a loft structure. Are there any reasons, can you give me any reasons why, perhaps each of you in turn, why you didn't accept council's suggestion in that regard?
So from my perspective, this is 215 Albany Road. This is Milan Milosevic here, David.
Yeah, yes,
yeah, look, from my perspective, we took the loft structure to be an interpretation of bulk and scale. And so we did take on board council's comment on that. And we reduced the overall bulk and scale by over a metre in terms of height. That is still less than the height. It's significantly less than the height of the tip of the pitch roof of the double story terrace at the front of the premise. And it's it's still less than the height of the flat roof at the back extension of the terrace. So from our perspective, we definitely took on board the council's comments, and that was the basis for us submitting revised plans to the council, being significantly less bulk, i.e. a meter shorter in height than what was originally submitted. So I'll probably leave it there and pass to Mr. Giles.
Okay, yeah, Mr. Giles, if he's there. Paul Giles, are you there? Maybe he's left. Well, just in response to your comment there, so you agree and acknowledge that you have not, you've reduced the bulk and scale a little bit, but you have not responded to with a design that would be in any way referred to as a loft structure. Would you agree?
No, I disagree. I would say we have amended our drawings to the council, and our drawings are consistent with other applications in the local area. And by reducing the height by well over a meter, so a significant reduction in height, you know, that should be interpreted as complying with council's request.
But council's request, as I understand it, was to make it more as a studio, a pitched roof effect above the garage, which is quite different to what we have, even though you may have lowered it.
Yes, that's exactly my point.
Sorry, I think we're confusing two matters. One is we're saying a loft, which is an extension of an existing premise, versus a pitched roof. So maybe if you can please clarify what you mean as a distinction between a loft and a pitched roof, that would be appreciated.
Well, a gabled roof rather than more of a box element.
So I guess from my perspective, I have submitted a number of photos in my A4 submission, none of which are gabled roofs whatsoever.
I guess that doesn't answer the question in terms of council's DCP, what it's trying to achieve in the area.
So I think what I'm looking for is clarity then around why certain properties require a pitch roof versus other properties don't require a pitch roof. So what has changed in the planning regulations to necessitate a pitch roof in this example?
I think the answer is that this site is within a heritage conservation area, and any proposal should respond to the heritage conservation area in its characteristics in relation to its roof form and other design elements. That's the controlling factor.
So the part I'm confused about, Mr. Chair, is directly behind me is a warehouse conversion with a flat roof that was built less than 6 months ago. It actually only just completed construction, 2 months ago. So I'm not sure what's changed in the Heritage Conservation Area Act that would necessitate me to vary my design compared to, say, a structure that's less than 4 meters away from where I live.
I don't know. I mean, a warehouse conversion may involve different considerations. I really don't know.
And additionally, Mr. Chair, if I may, just to complete the point, I've spent a lot of time, meticulously renovating my place of premise and my dwelling, particularly from the streetscape view on Albany Road. So this is all in relation to a rear lane addition on top of an existing garage. This will not be visible from the streetscape whatsoever. And if someone is in the rear lane, they will see those photos I submitted in that A4 paper I've provided to the panel, and they will see you know, a combination of flat roofs and pitched roofs, as opposed to a consistent, you know, presentation of either pitched roofs or flat roofs as well, for what that's worth.
Yeah. I just feel that you've answered in both cases, the two properties. The council comment back to you was the Balkan scale of the structure. They have a concern with the Balkan scale of the structure and for the structure to be designed more akin to a loft above a garage. I think I take what your point is, and that is that you have modified the Balkan scale of the structure by reducing the height, but you have, from my take on it, you have not done much to redesign it to be more akin to a loft structure above a garage. If everybody in the back lane did box structures like what you're talking about, it would just present as a canyon and a massive wall, I would have thought.
I guess that's why I submitted to this committee the photos that are, you know, recent developments, and that are developments that have been, you know, within 300 odd metres of where I reside. So I'm not sure about where this concept of a gabled or a pitched roof has come up before. And so, you know, this is new to me, if you like.
I mean,
I guess it depends a little bit on your interpretation of what the meaning of a loft structure is.
Have you seen the plans that have been recommended for approval for your neighbour at number 217?
Yeah, I have indeed, Mr. Chair. We're using the same architect across all three. So 217, 215 and 209 are all using the same architects.
Mm. Yeah, but with different designs.
Correct.
All right. Well, we'll consider what's been put to us and announce our decision in due course. And again, we thank you for your input.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
All right. So that we can now move on to item number 10, 20 Merton Street, Roselle, demolition of an existing dilapidated house and construction of a new one. Recommended for approval. Mr. Betros is the planner for the applicant. Mr. Betros, you would have seen that the application has been recommended for approval. Do you have any comments about any of the conditions, in particular the condition requiring the removal of the structure at the rear?
I do. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak before you.
Yes, please.
I was actually involved with a similar site further up to the west, which you may have noted if you did a site inspection. It's the site adjacent to the council car park at the top of the hill, and it has a garage with a studio first floor structure in a loft style, very similar to that proposed. In my opinion, the design of the structure is quite subtle, as you can see in the studio floor area, in that it doesn't occupy a large proportion of the garage structure. And if I can point that out on drawing, sorry, go with that. DA04. And you'll note that the habitable area is located well away from the laneway boundary. And that's also suitably demonstrated on DA06. And on both section diagrams. So it will very much to the street, sorry, to the lane, I should say, as a single-storey structure with a roof, no doubt. But in my opinion, not a significant form. And the rear lane south elevation on DA10 also shows that it's set in from both side boundaries. So it's not a wall-to-wall, or boundary-to-boundary, I should say, structure. You will note the clause 4.6 is where this is supported. And we consider that to be well-founded, and you would note within Council's interpretation of that FSR that is in fact including portions that we would not consider to be FSR, but nevertheless we understand Council's interpretation. And if I can just point out that component being on DA06 again. Sorry if I could trouble you to go to that. It's the covered terrace area below the garage, which is open to the outdoor private open space. So I understand that it is covered by the garage above, but it is in fact open to the private open space area and, as you can see, well concealed from any surrounding property and the public domain. So we would request that that condition be deleted for those reasons provided. Just like to point out the substantial slope of that roof form away from the southern boundary, therefore not generating any adverse solar impacts or, sorry, shadow impacts to the neighbours across the lane. So we'll thereby request that that condition be deleted.
So you're seeking the deletion of condition 2, little b, little 1.
Correct. Yes.
Any questions from the panel?
No, I don't have any further questions.
No, thank you.
Mr. Chair, I was just interested in that, whether the gentleman was listening to the previous discussion, whether Mr. Betros was listening to the previous discussion, and he's smiling rather broadly, so I suspect that he was, and whether he had any comment based on that previous discussion and what the panel had been raising in that one comparative to this one.
I was listening indirectly. I was doing some work at the same time, I apologise, but I'm not sure if you've got access to the SEE. Page 13 is where we made reference to the other loft structure, which is a lot more visible being adjacent to the car park than this site. I think it does definitely constitute a loft, given the raking roof form, and it's set back from the adjoining properties.
Thanks for that, Mr. Betros.
Thank you.
Apart from that, are you happy with all the other draft conditions?
We are. Thank you very much.
Yes. All right. Well, we'll consider that and publish our decision in due course.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So with that, we can conclude the public meeting.